Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a video podcast that looks at global news events and brings you perspective and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. As always, we do appreciate a like or a follow, and you can find links to more of our episodes at thebriefpodcast.org. Since October 7th, 2024, we've focused mainly on the situation facing more than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The desperate Israeli hostages still being held by Hamas have their fates in the balance as well. Throughout all of these months, we've repeatedly heard calls for the U.S. to cut off the supply of arms to Israel, blamed in part for the devastating toll of around 50,000 human beings, with international aid groups estimating about two-thirds of those casualties are women and children. More than ever, it is the U.S. blanket support for Israel that has been called into question. But who holds them to account, and how? Our guest on this edition of The Brief Podcast is journalist Sam Husseini. He's a communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a Christian Palestinian. He's been a thorn in the side of various spokespeople at the U.S. State Department. A lot more on that coming up. Sam Husseini, hello, and welcome to The Brief.
Good to be with you, Jim.
You know, this is a very troubling time in terms of Gaza, but at the same time, it's a troubling period for U.S. foreign policy. What is it like trying to question American officials about the U.S. role, which some find very controversial?
It's a lot of frustration and occasional gratification that you can expose how those two things interrelate, how U.S. policy in its stated goals being so distant from its actual goals, if you can expose that, that feels like a breakthrough at times, but it's a long periods of frustration. For example, going to the State Department briefings and just not being able to get called on, you know, week in, week out, month in, month out. And not having a platform with a significant megaphone in order to get information out that you feel could actually make a difference if the wider public understood it in a timely fashion.
How important is it to the American public?
I think it's enormously important, and I think that there is tremendous effort put in by the political establishment, and I mean the political establishment including from Donald Trump to much of the Democratic Party, in order to mold the public mind, in order to obscure from them what I believe is the criminality of U.S. foreign policy in so many ways, to use distractions, to use false equivalencies, a whole series of mechanisms to prevent the public from seeing the reality, because I think ultimately they're afraid of the public seeing the reality, that it might wake up and it might make a significant difference.
Now, this all really came into sharp focus during the Secretary of State Blinken's final press conference. He went to the State Department, and it was almost a triumphant moment where, you know, he was going to, you know, list all of his accomplishments. And you wanted to break into that. And you had a long history as an independent journalist. Let's begin there. You have a long history as an independent journalist of trying to pressure the State Department spokesman and others about just what is going on and what is U.S. involvement and what do they understand that to represent?
Yeah, it's been my philosophy for some years now that the more conflict there is in a news conference, the more peaceful the outside world is. If everybody's sitting there all schmoozy and nice, there's going to be more violence, more carnage, more bloodshed on the outside. If we're able to confront the facts, the inconvenient truths about U.S. foreign policy in the news conference, then that limits their use of violence. You know, they've dragged out the genocide in Gaza for well over a year, and he comes out there. They finally have a so-called ceasefire, and I can get into how that came about, which was rather insidious.
Even before his final press conference, you had a succession of confrontations with the spokesman. I want to share that with our audience right now.
Go Do the Geneva Conventions apply to Gaza or not? Apply to everywhere on the planet except for the Palestinians. Isn't that right?
We continue to stress everywhere and everywhere that international humanitarian law needs to be abided by and respected.
Do the Geneva Conventions apply?
You are now interrupting your colleague. Go ahead.
I'm interrupting you. I'm insisting on an answer to a critical question.
Aren't we not now in a situation where Israel may be using the Hannibal Directive not just on Israelis, civilians, and military, but on U.S. citizens and other foreign nationals?
So I am not familiar in any way with either that supposed directive or those reports.
You've never heard of the Hannibal?
Certainly would not want to comment on it.
You've never heard of the Hannibal Directive?
I thought you wanted to go out of the region.
Sure.
Does the U.S. recognize the Geneva Conventions as applying to Palestinian territories?
Sam, what I'm just going to say is what you've heard us say before is that
I'm
we believe
in that. I'm asking you
That's the answer that I have for you, which is that we believe wholeheartedly that Israel has every right to defend itself and to defend its security. And what happened on October 7th would be unacceptable to any country. And steps must and should be taken.
About another,
steps must
about-
and should be taken to ensure that those events cannot be repeated. Now, I've taken three of your questions.
I'm going to work one through them. Alex,
another.
Thank you.
What was happening there?
What was happening there was that I very rarely got called on in order to ask a question. And part of what I wanted to focus on was if the U.S. public understood that the U.S. government does not recognize, that's obviously their policy, they do not recognize that the Geneva Conventions apply to the Palestinians. They apply everywhere around the world except for Palestinians. And it's what that is basically a legal construct to have Gaza be turned into a free fire zone. Just recently, in the last week or so, Switzerland was ordered to by the UN General Assembly to have a conference regarding the Geneva Conventions on Palestine, and they wouldn't do it because the U.S. government and the Israeli government got them not to, and ultimately because the U.S. public doesn't realize how flagrantly international law is being violated. So that's the substance.
You were essentially, like you said, they didn't call on you. You're an independent journalist. You're not a big outfit, but you expect to be called on sometimes when you have points to raise. But you actually recorded the spokesman, didn't you? What happened there? You just basically got informed of what?
Yeah, well, they kept avoiding, the junior spokesperson, the deputy, kept avoiding answering the question. And then when I finally, on a rare occasion, got called on by Miller, I think he called on me twice in over a year. And he deceived, he was outright deception. He said, yeah, of course we recognize the Geneva Conventions. Like, what am I talking about? But he didn't say with respect to Gaza. So it was a deception. And I sort of, for a second got taken in by it. And he immediately goes to one of his other preferred journalists, some of whom, by the way, are not with big outlets. Some of them are one-man band, and they get called on day in and day out or under Biden.
You essentially found out they weren't going to call on you at all.
Yeah, right. Well, so the day after he claims to me, Miller, Matt Miller, that they are going to, that they, of course, abide by the Geneva Conventions, I go up to him and I say, Matt, did you mean to say with respect to Gaza? And he said, I said exactly what I meant, meaning that he doesn't apply it to Gaza. He's just broadly claiming, yes, we abide by the Geneva Conventions without any reference to Palestine. It was obvious to me and to everybody else in the room who was paying attention that they weren't calling on me for many months. And I finally cornered him and he effectively said it. The reason that he cited was one time when another reporter asked about the Lancet estimate of 180,000 dead Palestinians in Gaza, and he had this smirk on his face, which he frequently has, and I just blurted out, you're smirking. Do you realize that you're smirking? which, you know, I mean, in a way, I was doing him a favor. You'd think that somebody else at the State Department would say, Matt, can you please not smirk when you're talking about dead people? That's a bad look. And so he used that as a, you know, as a pretext to do what he had been doing anyway, which is not calling on me to say I'm not going to call on people who interrupt in that way. The fact of the matter is other journalists regularly interjected, most prominently Matt Lee from AP, not that I'm objecting to this, as well as others, but I, rather alone, was prevented from interjecting in a timely way when I would.
But then you decided that when Blinken was holding his final press conference, you weren't going to be denied. And I want to play out for the audience what it looked like when you tried to raise a point with the Secretary of State.
Thank you.
Let him answer some questions instead of making another speech every day.
Sir, would you like to be escorted out?
Go away.
You don't have the responsibility to tell me where to go. Do you want to be escorted out or not?
I want him to answer questions.
Okay, then let's be quiet.
I'm a journalist.
I look forward to answering questions in a minute.
I'm a journalist. I'm not a potted plant.
Everyone will have an opportunity to ask questions in just a minute. Thank you.
Miller has explicitly told me he will not answer my questions. I'm justified in what I'm doing.
I have no greater pleasure in this job than crossing off a list I carry in my pocket.
You don't want to
the names of those who have been arbitrarily detained and unfairly held hostage, unjustly held hostage, and bringing them home, returning them to their families, returning them to their loved ones. Finally,
get
I just
your
wanted
hands
to share
off
this
me.
Morning.
Get your hands off me. Get your hands off me. Get your hands off me. Answer a damn question.
I look
Do you know
forward
about the Hannibal Directive? Do you know about Israel's nuclear weapons? Everybody from the ICJ, I was sitting here quietly, and now I'm being manhandled by two or three people. You pontificate about a free press. You pontificate about a free press. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. I am asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions until I'm asking
questions.
Please, sir,
respect the process. We'll have an opportunity to take questions in a few minutes.
Wasn't the point of May 31st statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders?
Please, sir, respect the process. Thank you.
Respect the process. Respect this process. Well, everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't you in the Hague?
They literally carried me out, and then afterwards, when I got out of the room, they very roughly handcuffed me, grabbed me by the shoulders, jerked me around as they walked me out the building. I ended up with a concussion that I'm still recovering from. You know, what I was trying to do was interject questions. You know, I wasn't attempting to make a speech. I was attempting to pointedly ask things as Blinken was speaking. So when he talks about, you know, diplomacy, I raised the question about the Geneva Conventions. When he talks about getting the hostages back, I ask about the Hannibal Directive, which is an Israeli policy of killing the captives, which they don't want to talk about, obviously. And so they had this construct, this new thing of this woman, I still don't know her name, who came up clearly at Matt Miller's direction to berate me and to get me to shut up. And that basically escalated things. My plan was to interject timely, short questions and try to get called on, or to at least make it obvious to everybody that they were not calling on me. I wasn't attempting to stop the news conference or to make a speech.
All right, so we're at that point right there. Were you disappointed that other journalists in the room didn't stand up to defend you, didn't stand up to say, wait, let's, you know, he's right, let's give him a chance to ask a question here?
Well, they kind of, you know, I was carried out by that point. Nobody objected, Max Blumenthal spoke earlier before I did, but I mean, it was worse than that. I mean, that you had journalists thanking Blinken for his, good work with the media and so on. So it was rather disheartening, I'll put it very politely, to say that. And I mean, there have been times at news conferences where other journalists have basically acted like apparatchiks, have been willingly used by the spokesperson to cut me off, for example, including, I should say, from establishment Arab media as well, Al Arabiya being the most prominent, being willful, which is Saudi funded, being willful tools of the State Department in terms of molding what happens in that room.
Essentially, that is the scene in the U.S. State Department. Is there a sense that they're trying to avoid the truth, obscure the truth of what's really happening?
Absolutely. I mean, there were numerous news conferences over the last 2 years where Max and I would get in there with one or two other tough journalists, and we'd have our hands up the entire news conference. And at the end of the news conference, everybody else would get called on except the two or three of us. That happened repeatedly. That happened repeatedly when I was there alone, and if Max didn't show up. So it was clear that they were avoiding anybody who might pose really rigorous questionings. They took some tough questionings from some reporters. Matt Lee at AP sometimes asks a good question. Saeed Erekat focuses on Palestine, but they don't ask the kind of real confrontational adversarial questions that Max and I do. And so we were avoided like the plague.
That puts you in a different class, more or less, but it also points up, is there a country club atmosphere here where people don't want to obey the club rules? They want to stay in that club and be members in good standing.
Absolutely. They want access. They want to get called on, and they know that they'll get called on if they, are really friendly and schmoozy and don't ask tough questions, and that leads to more access and maybe a one-on-one interview. And then, that gets them in good with their editors, I suppose, or something. And I should mention there's one other journalist, Liam Cosgrove, who, among other things, works with Zero Hedge. He's pretty right wing from what I can tell, but he actually picked up on my Geneva Convention question. He got Blinken in the hallway once. It was extraordinary. And he asks him about, do you recognize the Geneva Conventions as applying to Gaza? And Blinken says, is this on the record? And Liam says, yeah, it's on the record. And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to answer. So what the hell is that about? So Liam also gets blackballed. Why? Because he's asking tough questions, because he's asking the questions that expose the criminality of U.S. foreign policy. And so anybody who does that and ends up with, not getting called on. And then when you don't get called on, you're less likely to go in because, I'm blowing half a day by going into the State Department, sitting there with my hand raised the entire time. And at the end of the day, I got nothing to show for it. So it ends up bleeding you in terms of your very limited resources.
Do you anticipate that this was all under, a lot of this is completely under the Biden administration.
Correct.
Do you expect things to get worse now with Trump 2.0?
Well, they've had three news conferences so far. I've gone to two of them. They now put notices as to where you're supposed to sit. So they've got me sitting on the second to last row and right near the door. So a couple of people commented that they figure that if they feel like they want to haul me out again, it's a shorter trip for them to carry me out. There is massively more control so far. I used to be able to sit like on the fourth row, so I'd sort of be, kind of up and able to interject. Now I'm in the seventh row or something like that, seventh or eighth row.
Well, you would be in the midst of the press conference. You would be able to more easily address the speaker, whether it's a spokesman or whether it's a secretary of state.
Absolutely.
You consider this vitally important to the American people. That's what you have said. What are they supposed to get out of this when you confront somebody like that? People would say, you know what you really are? It's just a disturber. You're there, just there, a protester at these press conferences. You're not a real journalist.
Yeah, I would say quite the opposite. I am doing journalism as it's originally intended, or should be originally intended, and that is to ask the tough questions and not to be sitting there to be part of a country club, to be schmoozing. I'm there to ask the elephant in the room questions that may well make them uncomfortable, and I think that's what's desperately needed. We're supposed to have a democracy where with a well-informed public that can assert its will. We've got Congress basically largely, you know, on the AIPAC payroll. They're not going to be a balance in any meaningful sense to an administration acting in cahoots with Israel to slaughter people by the day. Who else is going to stand up for this? There are people, you know, out on the streets and chanting and protesting and whatever, and that's part of what you need in a democracy. But how exactly is that going to change policy? You need to directly confront individuals and force them to try to explain their contradictions and their lawlessness in a meaningful way. They dismiss international legal bodies like the ICJ and the ICC. Where else are people going to look to for some minimal measure of redress? It has to be with tough adversarial journalists, or at least it has to be a significant part of it.
Does your Palestinian heritage affect the fervor that you bring to all of this, the passion?
Maybe somewhat, but I don't think so. I mean, I certainly don't think it explains it. I've come analytically to the conclusion that Palestine is critical because Israel is the current last, hopefully, stage of the settler colonial project, which has dominated human life for over 500 years. That is, European settler colonialism did a great deal of damage throughout the world, from Asia and Africa and Latin America. And Israel is like the latest pretext of settler colonialism. And that general wider global project has to end. And there are calls. Eric Prince last year made a series of remarks about saying we need a new colonialism. So unless it is stopped in the case of Israel, I think it will resurface in a very much wider scale.
We have seen undoubtedly a focus on any discussion of Israel becomes highly sensitive, whether you're on campus protesting against Israel, whether it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or not, you're under more pressure today than I think ever before. What's your view?
I think that's true. I think it has reached a fever pitch, and I think that Trump is flipping the script on his America First and turning it into a very much an Israel First thing. But I do think that it's a long-standing thing, probably throughout my entire life, and certainly accelerated after 9/11. Your experience at CNN, others who were, you know, targeted because of, you know, statements or something. That is, I mean, I don't even have a full list, but I remember Rick Sanchez, Octavia Nasser, Mark Lamont Hill, that just at CNN, as well as yourself. And I'm sure I'm forgetting some people. There has been a systematic effort by pro-Israeli forces in the United States to drum out people who are independent-minded on the subject. I don't necessarily agree with all of the people that I just listed. I'm just saying that they don't, you know, conform lockstep to the dominant U.S. government establishment that works hand in glove with Israel so often. And meanwhile, you have the dominance of so much media, like on CNN, for example. Wolf Blitzer largely came out of an AIPAC-affiliated organization. And he's molded so much of and manipulated so much of the U.S. public mind over these decades. It's completely scandalous what has happened here. And I've never been in a major media outlet. I work independently and do what I can with the limited resources that I have.
You know, it's extended We have the case of the student, one of the students who led the protests at Columbia, Mahmoud Khalil. He didn't just get, you know, ostracized at the press briefings. ICE came to him, picked him up. He's now in a jail in Louisiana. And he issued a statement from jail. I want to read it, just what he had to say, because I think the new pressure, and it could come to journalists as well, but it came to this student who was on a green card and visa. He says, "I have always believed that my duty is not only to liberate myself from the oppressor, but to also liberate my oppressors from their hatred and fear. My unjust detention is indicative of the anti-Palestinian racism that both the Biden and Trump administrations have demonstrated over the past 16 months as the U.S. has continued to supply Israel with weapons to kill Palestinians and prevented international intervention. For decades, anti-Palestinian racism has driven efforts to expand U.S. laws and practices that are used to violently repress Palestinians, Arab Americans, and other communities. That's precisely why I'm being targeted." Do you see that as well?
I do, and I've seen that over the course of years, but accelerated after 2003. I mean, I went to the encampment at GW here in Washington, D.C. It was a beautiful encampment with students doing teach-ins, and they had a library and all kinds of things, and they bulldozed that thing out of there. They brought in the police and cleared out the thing and put up this huge fencing to prevent it from ever coming up again. And a student at GW just sent me these things about how they're putting up signs about how they care about free speech. You know, the brazenness of it and the way that it's being manipulated by the government. The government says that when Columbia clamps down on students and other private universities, that it's not a First Amendment concern. That's bull, because it is a First Amendment concern, because you have the government outright saying, we are going to cut off federal funding to these universities if they don't clamp down on this speech. That is a First Amendment violation, and that extends to, for example, big tech platforms like Twitter and Facebook and so on, which so often act in cahoots with the government in order to silence certain speech. So I think, you know, and obviously, I was just at a protest in front of the White House the other day. So many people were wearing masks, and I don't think it was COVID related. They're concerned about getting doxxed. The students are afraid of, you know, somehow getting in trouble for protesting. This is anathema to a free society, and yet this Israel exception to the First Amendment has become more and more pervasive. And it has, as Khalil says there, you know, permeated both the Democratic and Republican establishments.
Should the American people understand this? I mean, how vital do you think it is for people like you who stand up in the press briefings and ask the challenging questions that some would say that's just disruptive? Is there a need for you today more than ever before?
I think there is. I hope there is, and I hope it's not just me. I hope that it's more and more people, both inside the institutions and independent journalists like myself, push. You know, the First Amendment is, you know, use it or lose it, you know, and we're losing it. Silence is circling the drain, and when you're silent about what matters most and you have an outright slaughter, an outright genocide going on, and everybody's getting along to get along and distracting on other issues that are just partisan bickering or whatnot, that is going to cause further and further catastrophes.
Sam Husseini, independent journalist, stand your ground. We appreciate you. Thanks for being with us on The Brief.
Thank you so much, Jim.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore many of our other episodes of The Brief Podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Give us a like or subscribe. For a complete listing, you can find more information at thebriefpodcast.org. For now, I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.